New Year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. Now get a savory sausage McMuffin with egg, plus hash browns, and a small coffee for just $5.
For limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
From the number one sports site in the world.
Big names, bold interviews, beyond the X's and O's.
Welcome to the fastest 2 hours in radio
on Yahoo Sports Radio
and YahooSportsRadio.com.
This is the Big E Sports Show
with the one and only, the triple threat, the Big E,
Melissa Walker-Campbell. The 6 foot former Sooner women's basketball player.
She can post, pin, and produce with some of today and yesterday's biggest stars.
Alyssa Walker Campbell delivers sports the way you want it. Get ready to go beyond the X's and O's
with today's star athletes, coaches, and sports figures.
This is the Big E Sports Show
right now.
Now from the Quicken Loans studios of Yahoo Sports Radio.
Are you ready?
Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze.
Here she is, the one and only, the Big E, Alyssa Walker Campbell.
Okay, we are cruising right along at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We love hearing from you. Join us at Twitter at E Radio Sports. And our baseball conversation will continue as we have invited on this evening a very special guest, the Dean of American Baseball Writers, who joined MLB.com as a senior correspondent back in 2008. He has covered baseball since 1958. It's such an honor to have with us a gentleman who's been covering the game he loves for 56 years. That is Hal Bodley. Very much looking forward to highlighting his brand new book, which is titled How Baseball Explains America. Good evening, Hal. It's great to have you with us.
It's always my pleasure.
Well, congratulations on the book. As I said, we're going to talk about that here in just a moment, but we want to get your expert analysis on what you have seen throughout the first month of the season. And I think right off the top, what comes to the forefront of my mind, it seems like there's been, in terms of the narrative, there's been an unusual amount of injuries that have happened across the league. Would you agree?
Well, I think if we hadn't heard about Tommy John surgery, we certainly have this year.
That's true.
Because if you count the numbers, I believe there's about 14 pitchers who, since spring training, have undergone this surgery. So this is what's happening, and it's a shame that these pitchers are breaking down like they are. But I think that's probably been maybe the biggest news on the field, off the field, however you describe it.
Why do you think there is such an unusual amount and such a high amount of these injuries that are taking place?
Well, I think you can look back to when these pitchers are youngsters in junior high school, little league, that type of thing. I think there's so much emphasis put on them to throw the ball hard, because in a lot of ways their parents are living their dreams and all through their children. And so there's pressure put on these players to pitch well, to throw well, and they just do not have the strength at that age. And it manifests itself through high school and college, if they play in college, and the minor leagues. And when they get to the big leagues, I think the arms are so weak that they break down. That's my theory on it, but there are a lot of different theories on why it's happening. You really don't know. It could be the conditioning program in baseball today. They do a lot of lifting during the off season, which they didn't do. They do a lot of different types of stretching on the field before the game. There's a big question about why this is happening.
Well, the season must go on. What teams do you see being impacted the most by this?
Well, obviously, the Tampa Bay Rays have had a big problem because they lost Matt Moore because of this. Three of their starting pitchers actually are on the disabled list. Just about every team has a pitcher, it seems like, from the starting rotation who has gone down with some type of an injury. And it's something Major League Baseball has taken a long, hard look at.
Well, the Tampa Bay Rays, I'm glad you bring that up, because they have certainly had their fair share of injuries, and it's been up and down so far in this first month. What do they need to do to move ahead and try to salvage or rebuild the season? I mean, there's a long ways to go, but you want to get some momentum trending in the right direction.
You're positively right. Their biggest problem, it seems to me, is that I have two thoughts about the Tampa Bay Rays. Number one, they seem to have lacked the killer instinct. In other words, being able to get the big hit when they need to get it, being able to put the opposition away in certain times of the game, certain stages of the game. And secondly, their pitchers, their starting pitchers, have not been able to go deep enough into the game, which has put a tremendous amount of pressure on the bullpens. I believe losing those three key pitchers this year has been a big problem, although manager Joe Maddon says that, we have a lot of depth, we have good pitchers in the minor leagues, but being able to get their starting pitchers to go past five innings, I think, is the big thing.
You know, Hal, and it's so troublesome because what we think back a year ago, it's just so disappointing. What they had a 92-win season last year, right?
They really did, and many of us, me included, picked them to win the American League Eastern Division. I think they still can. The Yankees are playing quite well right now. But I think the Rays will be okay. Luckily, the pitchers have gone down early in the season, and there could be two sides to that. Number one, when they do come back, they will be more rested than had they pitched in April and May or however long it's going to take before they come back. So that's a good plus. And I think Tampa Bay has the best all-around team in the division, certainly. So we'll just have to wait and see if they can put it all together.
Well, Hal and I...
They got off to a bad start last year.
Yeah, I agree with you, too. And one thing about Tampa Bay is the fact that they probably get more bang for their buck than any other team in the MLB, right?
They really do. I mean, when you look at the payrolls, I mean, they're way down near the bottom of the 30 teams. And the management there, Joe Maddon and the managers there, the managers in the front office there, they've done just a fine job of putting this team together.
Well, I certainly have a ton of respect for what they have been able to accomplish. Really admire that particular organization. Hal, let's talk about the new book that you have just released, How Baseball Explains America. You've done many. What was the inspiration behind this?
Well, really, when you think about baseball and how important it is to our society, I mean, it's somewhat of a lighthearted thought, but how many times during the day do you use a baseball term to describe most anything? That's not the purpose of the book, but the fact that it weaves into our society so deeply, that's why I wanted to write it, and I think that's really what it's all about.
Well, and you also highlight the greatest decade. Give us a sampling of some of the players that you highlighted.
Well, I think you have to start with Joe DiMaggio and his 56-game hitting streak in 1942. Of course, Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1942. Ted Williams hit 400 in 1942. It was really the greatest decade at all. I mean, Williams batted 406 in 1941. The Yankees won 5 American League pennants. The Cardinals won 4 National League pennants. Jackie Robinson, Ted Williams. I mean, it's all part of the 1940s, and I think that's why it's such an important decade.
Well, that decade really did have such an enormous impact. How did baseball at that time comfort and heal from the trauma of the war?
Well, I think it was baseball has always been able to come along. I mean, you know, think back after 9/11, how when President George W. Bush went on the field at Yankee
yes.
Stadium
mm-hmm.
and threw the first ceremonial first pitch. How important that was. I mean, they gave him a rousing, standing ovation and chanted America, America, that type of thing. That was later, but of course in 1942, the players were coming back from the war, and I believe the company was certainly in need of a quote-unquote fix, and baseball provided that for them. It always has been able to do that.
Well, and baseball, too, they really didn't have any competition in terms of like football or basketball at the time. I mean, baseball truly was at the forefront.
That's right. That's right. It was always the national pastime, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
We didn't have the tremendous interest in football and basketball and those sports that we have now. It was the sport. I mean, and luckily, President Roosevelt allowed it to continue during World War II, and that was a big thing. I mean, the teams were not very good because many of the key players were overseas fighting for our country, but the sport did continue.
Well, there's so many wonderful chapters in this book. It is titled How Baseball Explains America. Hal Bodley has been with us, the legendary writer, and it's such a pleasure to have you with us, and we look forward to catching up with you again real soon. Congratulations on your book.
Thanks an awful lot. I hope we can do it.
Absolutely. Much more straight ahead at YSR, the Big E Sports Show.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on Yahoo Sports Radio.
Once again, the host of the fastest 2 hours in radio, here's Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
The Big E.
Okay, keep it right here at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I am Alyssa Walker-Campbell. As our NBA playoffs, the first round coverage continues tonight. Several series that we have highlighted, one in particular we're getting ready to, and we're keeping a very close watch on, is the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Memphis Grizz. I have to tell you, it has been absolutely fascinating to watch for a number of reasons. Just watching how much the momentum has shifted back and forth in this series. We saw Oklahoma City dominate game one, Memphis showing their resiliency, their bounce back ability in game two, and it is a pleasure to welcome in on this Friday night the sports director from Fox 25 Television in OKC, and that, of course, is Myron Patton. Myron, how are you?
I'm good. I'm enjoying these NBA playoffs, not just the series. I'm obviously covering Oklahoma City and Memphis, but, man, I think these playoffs for the first round have been really, really good, especially in the Western Conference.
Absolutely. I mean, the Spurs and the Mavericks, we've hit on that tonight, too. I mean, who would have thought? But you never count Dallas out when you got a head coach like Rick Carlisle and Monte Ellis. He's been terrific.
No doubt about it. And, you know, when you got, you know, Dirk is still Dirk, but Monte Ellis, I think, is a big key for them because he's the one guy, I think, that if you're the Spurs, say, how do you match up with him? He's been really good.
Well, I love his attacking mindset. Well, let's get right to it. Let's talk about OKC and Memphis because it's been compelling to watch for many different reasons. I think back even, Myron, a year ago, how Memphis really displayed dominance against the Thunder. But, of course, you know, OKC, they were missing Russell Westbrook. The Grizzlies have certainly shown that they can be a very dangerous team and very capable of making a deep run. What is your belief?
For sure. I mean, they're not your normal seventh seed. Now, the West is always really tough, and this year was no different. But you look at Memphis, you know, they missed Marc Gasol for portions of the season. That probably hurt them quite a bit. But the style that they just normally play really is kind of conducive to what you do in the playoffs. The playoffs come more half court, you know, not as much up and down. That fits their style perfectly. And they've, you know, their defense translates to the postseason as well. So, it's not a normal 7-seed. I think Oklahoma City, they knew this was going to be a tough first-round series for them.
You know, it's interesting you bring up Marc Gasol. I mean, he did. He missed 23 games, and the Grizz, with his return, went 34-13. They were 10-13 when he was out of the lineup. Of course, he was last year's Defensive Player of the Year. But let's go back to Game 2, Myron. How big of a win was that for Memphis? I mean, we saw that improbable shot falling out of bounds from Kevin Durant. I mean, it was a miracle. I believe that child is anointed. But how big was that for Memphis to be able to regroup and be able to go out there and finish a road game like that? I mean, it's so tough to win in OKC.
Yeah, it was. That shows how tough they are because from an emotional standpoint, they had control of that game. The Oklahoma City manages to get to overtime. The crowd's going nuts. You figure they might ride that wave and win. Instead, Memphis jumped out to the lead there in overtime and won it. So that just shows how tough they are. And obviously, with Oklahoma City having the home court, Memphis had to win at least one there. But you know, I think both these teams, you know, they can win on each other's home court. I think they're both, you know, Oklahoma City, from an experience standpoint, they've been to the NBA Finals. They've been to a lot of different things. So they can win in Memphis. Memphis can win at Oklahoma City. To me, it just gets down to which style kind of rules out that night and what the story, you know, how things play out.
You are listening to the voice of Myron Patton, the sports director at Fox 25 Television in Oklahoma City. And I guess what is a little bit bothersome for OKC Thunder fans is that now the Grizz, they have that mental edge that they really can beat the Thunder. I mean, when you have the belief as a player, you know this. I mean, it can take you far.
Yeah, and of course they did last year, and they got to the West Finals, and even though they've changed coaches, I thought Lionel Hollis did a really good job last year. He's not.
I was surprised at that.
Well, yeah, and I think that was just basically, you know, a difference with management in terms of how they wanted to kind of do some things. Lionel Hollins is a very good coach. And
very much so.
Back in the league real soon. But it's the same players. Mike Conley was good. Gasol, Randolph, you know, Tony Allen, who's done a really good job defending Kevin Durant. So these guys believe they can beat Oklahoma City. And so they were not shocked by it. I think it's for them. They want to play it more half-court possession to possession. Oklahoma City wants to kind of get up and down the court. Now, Oklahoma City can win a half-court game. They've shown that, but certainly it benefits them if they can make it a transition game. But you got to do that. You got to get stops. And they didn't get enough stops early in the series that one loss.
Mm-hmm. And I think what's perplexing too, Myron, is that, you know, we know the Grizzlies, they're not one of the best offensive teams in the league. I mean, what did they score the other night? 100-plus points, and that's only happened, what, 27 times this year. What kind of adjustments do you see Scott Brooks making as the series continues to go on?
Well, the biggest thing when they lost home court in Oklahoma City was the guards were really penetrating, getting inside. Grizzlies had 56 paint points, and you figure, well, okay, Gasol and Randolph. Well, it wasn't all them. I mean, Beno Udrih came off the bench, got 14 points in 14 minutes. Mike Conley got in the lane, was able to penetrate. And so if you're Scott Brooks, you've got to do a better job defensively, keeping those guards in front of you, pick and roll, whether you're going underneath or fighting through the pick, hedging on the pick. I know you understand all this mm-hmm. stuff, I mean, in terms of how you play pick and roll, but they got to get on the same page with that, keep those guys out of the lane. If they can get stops, you can get rebounds, push the pace, and maybe get some fast break points. in game one, they had 32 fast break points. In game two, they only had 16 fast break points. So I think it starts on the defensive end for Oklahoma City first and foremost if they're going to win this series.
Okay, just a few more minutes with Myron Patton, the sports director from Fox 25 in OKC. And one guy you can't ever underestimate, too, is Mike Miller. I mean, he is Miller time, and he can hit that three ball. What was he, 3 or 4 the other night and played 25 minutes?
Yeah, you know what? He's one of those guys, you know, the regular season seems like always something's hurt. You know, he did this Miami for those two rings they got. And, I mean, he might pull a muscle getting off the bus or something. But in a big game situation with a big shot to be made, he seems like he always comes through. And that's what they brought him back there for. He's not going to be a starter, but he's still got one of the best-looking jump shots. He's one of the guys who's got a textbook form.
Absolutely.
One of the big shots he made, he'll make it.
Talk to us about, quickly, just KD. I mean, he's had this just incredible, another sensational season. Is he your MVP?
Oh, sure. Sure, yeah. I think he and I still think LeBron's the best player. But I think Kevin's had the best season. And, you know, he's improved, you know, in all areas of his game. He's a better defensive player. He's working harder at that. Not as good a defensive player as LeBron, but he's gotten better at it. You saw what he did when Russell was out for different stretches of the season. How he just took the team on his own shoulders. So, yeah, to me, he's the runaway MVP this season, I doubt.
You know, we've seen the defensive improvements from KD, but, I mean, Myron, you've been there the entire time since KD arrived in Oklahoma City. What other areas have you seen him grow, evolve as a player?
I think leadership, you know, realizing that it's, you know, being a leader is not always just scoring the most points. Is taking some responsibility on yourself, you know, his ability to get other shots, his ability to step up and put himself on the line when there are plays to be made and not necessarily looking to kind of, you know, just to somebody else. And I think he's just grown immense. And, of course, he's only 25 years old, and it took a while to get to that point. But I just think he's worked on all facets of his game, and you've seen that at different points of the season this past season.
Okay, so we still have a little bit of time. Okay, so you're talking about KD, how much he has grown and the improvements we've seen in certain facets of his game. What about Russell Westbrook?
See, I love Russell. I know a lot of the national media, that's always this thing the last couple of years, does he shoot too much? I mean, sometimes, I mean, Kevin Durant won another scoring title this year. I think people think if Russell weren't here, Kevin would average like 45 points a game or something. I mean, if Russell just get out of the way, he would really, really score a lot of points.
He is fun to watch.
But no, he's a very good player. He fits in perfect for what this team needs. He's kind of the engine, the emotional engine that they need to push. Kevin is not that guy. He's a great player. He's their best player. But Russell is their emotional engine. If they're going to win a title, they're going to be Russell Westbrook playing at his optimal level if they're going to get that done.
Okay, Myron Patton has been with us at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Sports director with Fox 25 out of Oklahoma City, always doing a fantastic job. Of course, Game 4 in Memphis Saturday, and that will be a 9:30 tip Eastern time, and you can watch that on ESPN. Myron, what a pleasure. It's great to have you on the show, and we look forward to catching up with you again real soon, okay?
All right, enjoy it.
Absolutely. Much more straight ahead at YSR, the Big E Sports Show.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on Yahoo Sports Radio. Once again, the host of the fastest 2 hours in radio, here's Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
The Big E.
Okay, our coverage continues at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. And as promised, it is time to talk some college football, specifically the Big Ten Conference. News this week is that the Big Ten Network released its prime time schedule. I mean, how about that? I can't believe that's already happening. And Ohio State is going to have its fourth night game on this year's schedule. It'll be against Cincinnati. So we are going to get into that in our next segment. We're also going to take time to preview the NFL draft. I know it's still a few weeks away, but we want to take a closer look at some of the intriguing prospects that are on board. We want to get a snapshot of that. So always a divine appointment each and every week with Husker great, the one and only Jason Peter. How are you, Jason, this weekend?
I'm good, E. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. The sun is shining down here in Houston. All is well, and we've got a big weekend of NBA playoffs. We've been hitting it hard on our show, but we want to focus our attention on college football. So the schedule from the Big Ten Network, it is out, and tell me why Urban Meyer, he has a preference for night games, because I understand that it kind of helps out with recruiting, doesn't it?
Yeah, for a place like Columbus, where you can get
you could get a lot of these kids in on direct flights, or at least from that East Coast area. Those kids can play their games on Friday nights, and they can still have a weekend recruiting trip. To be able to experience the horseshoe, with 100,000 people in it, screaming their heads off under the bright lights. It's an environment that all coaches, I believe, it's their ideal situation. Now, it's interesting because Kenny Bell, who is wide receiver for the Huskers, he had tweeted out something saying, "What's with all the night games?" Kind of smack my head, that SMH that these kids are using nowadays. And I said, no, this can't be what I think it is. And I look into it a little more, and he tweets some other stuff, and he's like, yeah, he much prefers the 11 a.m. kick. This way, he can see his family later on in the night, and his routine's not too, broken up. And I was just, I was in shock. I was in awe. I just, as a player, that is your, I don't know how to put it. It's what you hope for every Monday morning, or, whatever it is when the schedule is made. They can obviously always make those last minute changes and move games to prime time. And that's kind of what you always hope for as a player, to be able to go out under lights, kind of sit around in the hotel. Both teams are at full strength, right? There's no West Coast team that's flying across the country and they got to play, a kick or early kick or vice versa. This is, both teams have been in the hotel room. Both teams have had time, for all their players to see the trainers, for meetings, to get a good night's sleep. There's no excuses for when you play under the lights. And so I was a little shocked when I heard him. And supposedly that's a more common feeling than I was aware of. Apparently a lot of guys enjoy now playing either the early kick or a 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock kick.
Okay, so the Buckeyes, they're going to have four night games in 2014. Let me ask you, during your career, your collegiate career, did you guys have night games? How many did you have?
We did. We probably had I would say maybe three or four.
Did you like it? Did you like that, Jason? Or did it kind of, you're a creature of habit. As a player,
I loved it.
You did? Why?
I loved it. There was nothing better, whether it was at home or away. And maybe it's different now because these kids now, they know that every game is basically on national TV. No matter where they're from, if their parents or their friends have a satellite dish or there's a local bar that they can go to, chances are you're going to be able to see, any game that you want. But back, 10, 15 years ago, that wasn't the case. But you knew that if you were playing prime time, that you were going to be either in half of, the television sets across the country or all of them. And it was a special thing. The juices get flowing just, that much more. But I guess kids are different breeds these days.
Well, okay, so you talk about some of the potential benefits of having night games, the greater exposure, increased, the television audience. Okay, so it's not just the Buckeyes that are going to have more increased coverage on night games, but Nebraska's going to have more on their schedule too. Is that correct? They're going to be playing, host to Illinois?
Yeah, Nebraska's got a few games
I think more than any other Big Ten school.
What's that?
More than any other Big Ten school when you combine.
Yeah, and it's funny because there's still, some fans as well that it's going to take some time to get used to around the Big Ten country. And to me, I thought it was a given that fans would just be able, much more enjoy being able to tailgate pretty much the whole day. There's just something special, about playing under lights. It's the same as in high school. You could go back to, the whole Friday night lights
thing. Absolutely.
And it's just, there's something special about playing under the lights. Maybe not so much anymore, but I thought for the fans and for the players, at least in my eyes, I thought it would be kind of like a dream come true. But yeah, Nebraska's got a bunch of night games on, which ultimately brought out that comment by Kenny Bell. But yeah, it seems like the Big Ten, they've got to do something to stay relevant. And if it means playing games at night to be able to get those television sets tuned in, then that's what they have to do.
Okay, so playing host to Illinois, that's going to be September 27th. Then you guys travel to Northwestern on October 18th. And that certainly has, I think that's budding. It's evolving into a bit of a rivalry. I mean, you look at the last three outings. I mean, it has definitely been very intriguing to watch. I mean, just how the Wildcats have really performed.
Yeah, and I can't say that I'm thrilled as an alumni and a former player of Nebraska.
You've expressed those opinions before.
That, you know, we've been having some great games against Northwestern, and not to take anything away from the job that Pat Fitzgerald has done, but, you know, you kind of hope that the games that you're known for are against the Ohio States or the Michigans or the Michigan States. You know, not Northwestern, and so it is what it is. You know, they certainly, there's something there that these guys, both sides, they come prepared and they come ready to play, and there's usually a good game to be played, at least from a fan's perspective. Mm-hmm. They usually provide you with a good one.
Jason Peter with us at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Indeed, it is our weekly Under the Helmet segment. And I'll tell you one game out of the Big Ten Conference that I'm definitely circling is when Cincinnati's going to be at Ohio State. I mean, that's Urban Meyer's. He's going to face his alma mater, and the Buckeyes have won 10 straight in a row.
Yeah, I wouldn't bet against Urban on this one. I like what he has up there in Columbus. I just think that he's just scratching the surface. I mean, it was what, 2 years ago that he took this job, and you know, he's had 2-3 solid recruiting classes. Now's when you're going to start to see those players, and he had a specific player in mind. You know, he. Obviously, spending all those years down in the SEC and the SEC country, he knows the type of D linemen that he's used to getting. Those are the guys that he's bringing up to Ohio State. I mean, he's got obviously the reputation. He's got the credentials. These guys will follow him. He puts guys in the NFL, which obviously, you know, I think for most kids today is probably number one on their list as to how they pick a school, and Urban will get you there. You know, if you've got the talent, you know, he's putting first rounders out left and right. So kids look for that. And but yeah, I just think now his players are really starting to find themselves in starting positions in the two deep, and it's you know, another year with Braxton Miller, I think, who continues to grow. I think they're going to be solid.
Well, there's no doubt this year will be very special in 2014 in one of the deepest draft classes. Jason, we look forward to your insight, your perspective on that. You know exactly what that's all about, and we'll talk to you next week. Have a wonderful weekend with Sarah and the girls, okay?
Thanks for having me.
Much more straight ahead at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Join us online at Twitter at E Radio Sports. We will be right back.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on Yahoo Sports Radio.
Once again, the host of the fastest 2 hours in radio. Here's Alyssa Walker Campbell,
the Big E.
Okay, welcome back to Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. As we continue to roll along with the fastest 2 hours in radio, I am Alyssa Walker Campbell. Love hearing from you. Join us online at Twitter at eRadioSports. And once again, it is time for a change up. We're now going to focus our attention on the AL East and those Boston Red Sox. And how about in 2013, the Red Sox, they capture the franchise's third World Series title. It was their third win since 2004. And without question, I mean, there's so many great storylines. It played such a huge role in helping the city of Boston heal and move forward from the bombings. So, in in our history lesson tonight, we're going to flip back the calendar 10 years ago when Boston finally was able to embrace a very happy ending as they had thirsted mightily 86 long years for a world championship. I'm looking so forward to our next conversation as we have invited on Alan Wood. He is the author of his new book, Don't Let Us Win Tonight, an oral history of the 2004 Boston Red Sox Impossible Playoff Run. It is a compelling read. Hello, Alan. It's good to have you with us at YSR.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know that baseball fans are certainly going to love this book because it is not just for the diehard Red Sox fans. I mean, it was so inspirational for me just to go through this and just really this seemingly impossible postseason, how it unfolded. I know I've kind of set the stage. Just kind of take it from there and just how it all just came together.
It is amazing how it all came together, especially the ALCS against the Yankees, with the Red Sox being down, losing the first three games, and needing to win four in a row, or else their season was over. In talking to the players, my co-author Bill Nowlin and I talked to almost everybody on the roster, so we got to hear from a lot of players who hadn't really spoken about the 2004. Postseason since it happened.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, we've heard from Dave Roberts and David Ortiz and Curt Schilling kind of periodically through the years, but there's a lot of players like Mark Bellhorn, Derek Lowe, Curtis Laskanik, who played very key roles throughout the postseason, who we haven't heard from. And we tried our best to kind of take you through the three series against the Angels, the Yankees, and the Cardinals. But really give the players the stage and try to get out of the way, so to speak, and let them tell their stories.
And I want to hear what their stories were in terms of, especially with that Yankee series. I mean, things looked so bleak for Boston. I mean, they trailed the series down 3-0. I mean, one loss away from a long, cold winter. How were they able to finally turn things around?
They really believed in themselves and believed that they could do it. A lot of players told us that, and it didn't really seem like something said in hindsight either. After that horrible 19-8 loss in Game 3, they still were upbeat. I guess they really took it one game at a time. I mean, that's really a cliche, I think, but we really see it pay off here because, you know, to come in the next day and think we have to win four games, like it's an insurmountable mountain, you know, to climb, but to just take it, just winning tonight's game, you know, not thinking about anything else but that, and really believing in themselves and knowing that they were a good team and much better than a team that was about to be swept, they were able to do it.
Well, one particular player that I definitely wanted to hear his insight was talking about Dave Roberts. I mean, just his preparation for Game 4 against the ALCS. I understand that he was really terrific in the clubhouse and kind of encouraging these guys to move forward and not to think of the past but live in the present.
Yeah, and his preparation for stealing that all-important base in Game 4.
In Game 4, yeah.
In the bottom of the ninth in Game 4 against Mariano Rivera. We talked to him and he was quite explicit in his what he did to get ready a few innings beforehand, and it was really amazing because Fenway Park is a small park and there's not a lot of amenities even with the renovations that they've done even back then, and for him to get ready, you know, there's really no place to practice stealing a base during a game, and
right.
he also hadn't played in 10 days, so he was a little rusty, and it's a cold night, and he was just kind of running up and down the runway between the clubhouse and the dugout, trying to get his legs loose, you know, to go into the game if anybody got on base in that inning.
Of course, okay, we're talking about Dave Roberts, just his preparation for stealing the most famous base of his career in the ninth inning of the ALCS Game 4. But what about Kevin Miller? Now, he wrote the foreword of the book, and he just talks about just what that infectious optimism and the team's pregame. What was the ritual of drinking whiskey? I mean, are you kidding me? Some Jack Daniels?
I think that started before Game 6 in New York, after they had won the two extra inning games in Boston. And at least for me, as a Red Sox fan, I really started to believe, like, they actually might do this. You know, they've come halfway. They Kevin told me a story of, I guess at Yankee Stadium, they play highlight reels of past Yankee greatness on the Jumbotron while the opposing team takes batting practice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're trying to, like, psych them out or something. But it was a cold night. It was kind of misty and rainy. And the Red Sox, he said, we're not going to fall for that stuff on the screen. You know, we're going to take batting practice in the cages underneath. And I think he had, on his way to the cages, had spied, I don't know how it was there, but a big bottle of Jack Daniels. And apparently, I mean, he's told different versions of the story. It kind of started out like they all did a shot before the game. Once that got out and he got some bad press about that, he sort of changed his tune, you know, and said, no, it was just a sip or it was symbolic.
Uh-huh.
But I think I'm not sure if it was the whole team either, really, but it was them bonding together and coming together to overcome these odds. And apparently, I guess, you know, because they won that game 6, they had to do whatever they did with the Jack Daniels. They had to do that before game 7 and then each game of the World Series as well.
Alan Wood, author, is with us tonight at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. The title of his book is Don't Let Us Win Tonight, an oral history of the 2004 Boston Red Sox. It was an impossible playoff run, an unforgettable October, no doubt about it. Can you give us a quick hit on Dr. William Morgan's description of that radical surgery that he performed on Kirk Schilling's right ankle? And that was right before the ALCS game 6 and World Series game 2, right?
Right. He actually performed the surgery twice. It really started out as a joke of what to do about Schilling's injury. Dr. Morgan, Theo Epstein, and Kurt Schilling were all kind of talking around, and Theo said pretty much as a joke, like, why couldn't we just, like, staple this errant tendon back where it belongs? And Dr. Morgan went off and tried to find an instance of this ever being done before, and he couldn't find one. So it was really radical in that regard. And while the Red Sox were playing Game 4, getting ready for Game 4, he was off practicing the procedure on a cadaver at the local morgue. Came in the next day. And Schilling was completely up for it. He was going to do anything that he could to try to pitch again. And the thing that I really kind of realized again was that they really had no idea what was going to happen to him. I mean, he went out and threw a great game in Game 6, certainly, and did it again in World Series Game 2. But going out there for the first time, Theo Epstein was talking about, like, they didn't know if he was going to actually be able to walk, or if he was going to throw, like, one pitch and collapse, or if the Yankees were going to try to bunt on him and make him run off the mound. You know, they really had absolutely no clue what was going to happen that night.
Well, Red Sox fans will never forget watching the 2004 postseason, and now they can read exactly how it happened in the players' words. And the title of the book is Don't Let Us Win Tonight, an oral history of the 2004 Boston Red Sox impossible playoff run. Congratulations on the book. Alan, it's been a pleasure having you on, and we look forward to catching up with you again real soon, okay?
Thank you very much, Alyssa.
Big thank you to Alan Wood, who we were just talking to, the author of the Boston Red Sox, Don't Let Us Win Tonight. Also, all of our guests this evening, we appreciate them joining us. Dan McCarney from the San Antonio Express News. Hal Bodley, of course, his new book that's out is How Baseball Explains America. And Mike Eisenberg from Fox Sports Detroit, the coordinating producer with the Detroit Tigers. And if these walls could talk, go check out a copy of his book, Detroit Tigers. Myron Patton, the sports director from Fox 25, getting you set and ready for the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Memphis series in Game 4 on Saturday night, and Jason Peter with our weekly Under the Helmet segment. I'm Alyssa Walker-Campbell reminding you to don't drink and drive. We'll see you next weekend for the biggest, the best in sports, the Big E Sports Show. So long, everyone.
Are we exposed? Security teams ask this every day. Vulnerabilities across network, cloud, AI, and OT silos hide the truth, and attackers are watching. Tenable unifies your tools, teams, and data so you can spot and close risks fast. Tenable's AI-powered exposure management gives teams one view of risk, helping them focus, take action, and close critical exposures fast. Visit Tenable.com. Tenable. Your exposure ends here.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.